Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at Surrey Farms. .com or virginiatraditions.com.
Yes, we're burning down the house on HeritageRadioNetwork.com yet again. The studio is in flames, and I wouldn't want it any other way. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, here with another dose of design, architecture, and the creative arts, the 18th of December, 2011. Our guest today is Chris Benedict, an architect of New York, one of the sort of stealth mode leading lights of doing what we all espouse these days to do, which is to make our buildings more high performing. But Chris's point of view, and she's got a verifiable, measurable track record, is doing more with less. None of this high-tech stuff getting around the energy code, not even looking at the energy code, just doing the right thing in one building at a time. Hi, come closer, say hello.
Hello, Curtis.
Hi, Chris. And you have a company that is, what is the name of your practice?
Well, currently we are Chris Benedict RA. We've had a few different names. None of them have been able to really suitably define us. So we're working under my name, Chris Benedict RA.
That's good. But I understand that you're in business partnership with Henry Gifford.
I am. Yes, he's my mechanical system designer and design partner.
Excellent. Those of you who are longtime listeners will remember that we first spoke with Henry on October 1st, 2009. And Henry sat right over here where Ryan Doyle, who's our guest interlocutor, who's been a guest here previously. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello, everyone.
All right. Ryan's here to ask questions that may have eluded me in the enthusiasm of the moment. God, there's so much to talk about. In no particular order, these are some concepts that or topics that I want to get into. Number one, the tyranny of energy modeling. This is from your list in the email that you sent me. Building science, or I would say the science of green. Absolutely, we want to talk about these new zoning amendments to the New York City zoning code, which are going to do... and I'm sure they'll be passed, really wonderful things for real estate development in a sustainable way in New York City. A little bit about Passive House. We've had several different episodes about Passive House. We know a good bit about Dr. Wolfgang Feist and the divorce between PHI and Fios. So we don't need to get into that too very much, except perhaps in passing. Buildings and energy. I want to ask you what do you do if a client wants a LEED certified building and you might not find yourself to be an adherent to the whole USGBC world, which is understandable under certain circumstances? What do you do if they want a LEED certified project? which then begs the question of the whole issue of certifications versus a measurable reality of the actual building. Maybe in passing we might talk about the Cascade Living Building Challenge and anything else that comes to mind. So let's have a little bit of shelter music. Roll the next break. Thanks. Down the house. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here with Chris Benedict. We're going to talk about low budget, high tech. Does that work for you?
Sounds good. That's
all right. So you have the mic. Tell us what you've been up to.
Wow. Well, I started my office in 1995, and I was fortunate enough to be able to renovate a group of buildings actually out here in Brooklyn and Crown Heights. And as I was in the construction of those, they were 13, they were substantial gut rehabs. I'm new in my office, I want to make
That's a huge commission.
Yeah, it was big. It was, a very lucky architect thing to happen to a young architect.
Absolutely.
While I was partially through the construction of those buildings, the projects were going well, and I really wanted to make a more environmental focus with my work, and I didn't know how. And this was in 1995, 1996. And so I started to attend a number of different conferences. The first one was the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association Conference, which is a great conference that anyone who's interested in buildings and energy should go to. It's held in March in Boston. And there I met Henry Gifford. This was 1996. We started talking about architecture, buildings. He had been working as a boiler mechanic and was actually quite negative about my goals of trying to make buildings more environmentally sound. But we did start working together. And we initially
why,
in this first...
Why was he negative about doing something about the buildings?
Well, you know, he started to expose to me something that really I didn't know, and I think most people don't know, which is that mechanical system design is terrible. The installation of the mechanical systems is terrible, and most mechanical systems don't perform. And I actually had the experience of him taking me into a building and showing me, taking me down to the boiler room and showing all the errors that had been made in the design and the installation. And then when we left the building, I said, a firm I used to work for was the architect for this building. You know, and it was really just one of these things that, you know, architects, they're, you know, they have a lot of things going on during construction, and they're monitoring the architectural parts of it. I think most architects is getting better, but they don't understand mechanical systems. And You know, then you open the boiler room door, you look in, you say hello, you walk out, and that's really actually where the fossil fuel is burned, at least a lot of it, and especially in housing. Sure. And so really what I started to learn from him was how much more I needed to know on the engineering side of being an architect.
Good.
And from there, we really started to pull apart how to work on buildings. In this first set of buildings, the 13, we actually took the mechanical system design out of the job and put in his mechanical systems. Mm-hmm. And we got those buildings successfully built. But we had the mechanical system piece kind of started. And then we moved on to more buildings where we could really take what I call a whole system approach or a holistic approach, which meant having a mechanical system that also works with a enclosure and a ventilation system and all of the pieces working together holistically. And so over the course of time, we've created some very high-performance buildings that were built for the same cost as typical construction, but we actually took this holistic point of view in the designs of them.
Well, how do you get a ventilation system? I'm supposing a mechanical ventilation system, something that uses electricity, into the mix of costs and still have the thing come in as a conventional building, let's say a conventional mid-rise apartment house, in most cases is still relying on opening the window for ventilation. So you have an alternative to that.
We started taking the following strategy to the design of apartment buildings. Every apartment in the building was built almost autonomously from the other, in the sense that an air barrier was built around them. And there's a number of techniques to do that. One that's very straightforward and really doesn't cost any more money is to build the air barrier around the apartment with sheetrock. And this is already part of fire stopping. It actually is a code requirement, although it's not usually conformed to. And so basically, when we take an apartment building, we have a number of distinct units that are compartmentalized from each other. So now they become vessels. They're tight, and within that vessel, then, you can make intentional openings, and you can exhaust air out of them. And I developed a ventilation system for the apartments that draws air out of the kitchens and bathrooms, where you need to have that by code anyway, but you would take the incoming fresh air from intentional openings, and in my case, something called trickle vents in windows. And so what we create in these living units then are nice autonomous units that get indoor or fresh air from the outdoor drawn in through these trickle vents and then exhausted out of the kitchen and bathrooms. You're not worried about smells or smoke or bugs or anything coming from the apartments that are adjacent to it. And they're very nicely fireproof now. They have great sound attenuation.
Sure.
And it creates really a beautiful living situation for people. And then with Henry's great mechanical systems, the apartments aren't overheated. So you have a very different feeling in an apartment that Henry and I designed than in most New York City apartments, where they're overheated, the air is stale.
Right.
The first thing you want to do is run over to the window and open it up to get your ventilation. Instead, you have fresh air and a 72-degree temperature.
Now, some people don't like trickle vents because, one, they're sort of ugly if they're part of the window assembly. So do you have trickle vents that are part of the wall assembly? Or
they do make them. I haven't used them myself, okay. But yes.
Also, the passive house people would freak out about that because there's no way of tempering the air that's coming in.
Well, that's interesting. It's kind of like we probably can relegate the trickle vent to the history books very soon. In 1996, when I started this, ERVs or HRVs, which are energy recovery ventilators or heat recovery ventilators,
yeah,
were not really being used commonly at all. And
still not really.
They're at least on the table now. Initially, you know, at that date, it was kind of a dream to be using these things. And energy recovery ventilators basically take incoming fresh air and do a heat exchange with outgoing warmed air and preheat the incoming ventilation air. Mm. And they're I call them the, like, they're the superstar of green right now. They're fantastic. But in 1996, the technology was not good enough for apartments, and the energy used by them was the same or more than the energy saved by them. And so at that point, it wasn't really a viable alternative. But we're definitely using them now in every place that we can. The ventilation system I'm describing, which now might be relegated to the history books, has really caught on here in the city, though, and it's been written into the New York City Code. It's basically, sure, you know, based on the work that Henry and I did and getting it kind of on the ground and operating.
Actually, really?
Yeah. Who would have thought my architectural career, I'd have a piece of ventilation code, you know?
So how, I'm just curious, how did that come about? You must have been rather vocal and political for that to happen. Well, I know, well, that, I know that Henry is vocal and political. We know about that. But you must have had to do a lot of lobbying.
Well, the first set of buildings that Henry and I did, where we used the complete system approach, it was 18 buildings now, a group of 18 in Bushwick area. And when they were completed, we sent out a press release and we held an open house. And we bought coffee and pastries and, you know, publicized this thing. And four people came.
And sounds about right.
Yeah. And so we proceeded, though, to start telling, teaching, talking at conferences. The people in the building science world were very aware of what we were doing because we're in touch with a lot of building science people. They're our close friends. We know the people who have invented various instruments. We've, you know, really gotten very tied into that world. And so in that place, we talked about this a lot, and people were very interested in it. So it started to gain steam, and then we started to get some articles, and we got the front page of the real estate section of the New York Times. I think that was in 1999 regarding this. And so people started to see that we're inventing stuff that's really economical, works better than how everyone has done it in the past. Why not give it a try ourselves? And then decided that since I had gotten special permission by the building department to use this stuff, it would be very nice if everyone could do it, and it was written into the code. And so it
you went for a code mod or
a reconsideration. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
which outside of New York, everybody calls code modification, but it's the same thing. Yeah. Friends of ours in Upper New England would call it code mod. Upstate, they'd call it. Anyway, so you got a reconsideration for using, for example, a trickle vent instead of the traditional 5% of the square footage of a room that's being ventilated through a window sash that you open.
Right. I mean, we still had operable windows. Yeah. You know, we never want to create buildings where people can't open their windows, so people are free to do that. But there's a lot of times of the year where you don't want to be opening the windows. If you're air conditioning, you don't want the windows open. If you're heating, you don't. So it's really the shoulder months where spring and fall, where you could open the windows. But in that case, sometimes you don't have a pressure difference between inside and outside, and you're not ventilating even in the shoulder months. So mechanical ventilation system it's a nice thing to have, and our goal is to make it work really well and to use very little energy.
Right. You mentioned that the people who were in the building science world were aware of what you were doing. Who are these people? What are the organizations? You can name names or organizations. I'm just curious.
Wow. Okay, well, I met Henry first. I would consider him to be in the building science world. He was a boiler mechanic who was also starting to be teaching at these conferences. Another person I met pretty early on in my career was a really profoundly intelligent guy, Terry Brennan. He's a physicist and a naturalist and also a building scientist. And he and I have worked very closely. And actually, the three of us, Terry, Henry, and I, are a nice team because we have hugely overlapping interests, but none of us are redundant. Like, yeah. I'm the architect, Henry's the mechanical guy, and Terry is like kind of the person who's running between the two of us with his creativity. He's also a builder, so we have his building expertise as well. And, there's many people. Gary Nelson, who runs the Energy Conservatory, Joe Stiebrick and Betsy Pettit of Building Science Corporation, many people involved in the national labs throughout the country.
People at Oak Ridge?
Oak Ridge and others, uh-huh. Yeah. And there was I felt like as an architect at that time, I was tapping into a world that I didn't even know was available. And many more architects now are tapping into this resource, but in the late 90s, it was very isolated from the architecture world. It was mostly building science. Were mostly critiquing architects for doing such a bad job with their buildings, but never actually really talking to architects at all about it.
Right.
And I was one of the first who just kept, you know, begging them to tell me and share this information. And then they would come and they would see the buildings built in the next couple of years, and they would, you know, I got a lot of street cred for that because, you know, I was actually practicing the stuff that they were talking about.
That's terrific. I like the approach of making it more like an engineering science and less like an art, so that you can say, well, it's not just me, it's all these other people say so. The whole building design guide, for example, you know that, yes?
No.
The National Building Institute, in conjunction with a bunch of federal agencies, from NASA to the Department of Navy, Department of Energy, have all vetted a database. It's available online. It's WBDG.org, I believe. Maybe Jack can check that while we're talking. And they have quantified and qualified details. Simple things like, this is one of my pet peeves, flashings, sill flashings, cavity flashings. Close off the cavity that's enclosing the wall so that vapor doesn't get into the mm-hmm. inside of the building, and it doesn't cause degradation. If you have a brick facade, for example, it will weep water into the cavity to keep that from getting into the interior. Simple things like that.
It's WBDG.org.
Thank you so much, Jack.
Who is that?
That's our engineer and executive producer, Jack Inslee. Thank you very much, Jack.
You're welcome.
And I find that very useful in terms of, in my own work, vetting our work and saying, well, it's not just my opinion. Here, look, mm-hmm. I can show you. Here's quantified science. All these federal agencies, we paid for it. We, as taxpayers, paid for it, and they've put it all together as a resource, and I think that's really good. Jack, let's have a little break about science, come back and talk about making science work for us. Burning down the house. I'm Curtis B. Wayne fumbling with my headphones. We're speaking with Chris Benedict, R.A., and Ryan Doyle is here as guest interlocutor. So far, Ryan hasn't had any questions. Yeah, okay, throw up your hands. Come on. Science. You know, building science is really great. And one way that the regulating authorities have attempted to codify conformance with good practice is through ASHRAE, American Society of Heating and Refrigerating, AE something or other, which is the granddaddy standard to which most energy codes refer. ASHRAE 90.1 is the code section that building codes point to, and often then people point to Appendix G, which lists a whole bunch of different things that you might do, but then ASHRAE takes no point of view as to whether any of these actually work. Which then gets to a topic that that you've posed in a list that you sent me. One slide is what it really takes to make a building perform better without increasing your building costs, because anybody can do all kinds of whiz-bang high-tech interventions that help raise its energy performance. I'm more interested in talking about a picture that I saw in some a bunch of different places where you're standing lovingly next to a exterior wall with brick, and you're pointing at what looks like mineral wool insulation, which is kind of cool because everybody's darling right now is extruded polystyrene, which has certain benefits, but and we'll talk about why not XPS versus mineral wool, but apropos of building, quote, science, close quote, let's talk about the tyranny of energy modeling. On almost every project of any size, eventually, most of us who don't have the background that you have rely on a consultant to model the building. And there are different platforms for modeling it. There's the DOE-2 model, which eludes me, perhaps that just part of my brain hasn't grown in, but I don't know how to use that. The Germans have some kind of modeling program, which is fine if you're facile with the metric system, which unfortunately here in the United States we don't have yet, which I hope we will. It would simplify things so much. Well, why do you feel that it's a tyranny, subjugation to energy modeling?
Well, I think the model gives a really false view of a building, and that falsity is even further falsified by the way some of these modeling programs are done, especially ones that are they're supposed to prove that you're meeting some percentage better than a code, which, you know, a code is not an amount of energy.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, that's
and,
right.
When... you're proving that you deserve a certain amount of grant money or whatever to be able to build a building because you've proven something in this model. And the problems with the models are they make a lot of assumptions. They're based on assumptions that can only work because of these assumptions. So they weigh unfairly certain types of technology as being better or worse. For instance, geothermal heat pumps, which are basically dogs, are given a lot of points in the
dogs
energy
out.
Modeling.
I love dogs. Come on.
Oh, you know, I did use the wrong word because I love dogs too. But
well, you but, at Heritage Radio, you cannot use pigs as a derogatory.
Atrocities.
Atrocities.
So there's
mangy
there's that
dogs.
Whole there's that okay. whole piece of it where some technologies are better weighted than others. But also implicit in the model are certain assumptions. For instance, the model assumes that you have a stable temperature in a building. Now, the only buildings I know of that have stable temperatures are mine. That you could actually run around with a thermostat
right.
and
Pat
measure
yourself on the
70,
back, Chris.
That you could measure 72 degrees in every room. And that's how the model's set up, that the building is performing in X way, when in fact most buildings aren't. I mean, I could walk in almost any building, any of us could, and we would see that that isn't the case. Why isn't it the case? Because there's either a poor architectural design, a bad enclosure design, a bad mechanical system design, bad construction, no monitoring, no commissioning. There's many reasons. And so, you know, Nissam Taleb had talked about, you know, in the world of finance, you know, something called the black swan, you know, and a lot of people were relying on certain kinds of models to indicate the health of the world financial system.
Sure.
And there came the black swan. I look at a construction of a building, the design of a building, construction of the building. It's a huge black swan. There are so many unknowns. And unless there is, you know, a well-thought-out design, well-constructed, well-monitored, and then tested, you don't have what this model is modeling.
Yeah, one of the little factoids that I've recently become aware of is that insulative materials do not behave the same under all temperature ranges. And in fact, some insulative materials exhibit properties that would suggest that they're undergoing a phase change even when they remain solid, like we just learned about aerated
autoclaved concrete.
Right, AAC, which under some circumstances is very good as a passive insulator, and under other thermodynamic circumstances can be a great radiator of heat and of moisture. And yet it remains solid all the time. So these scientifically provable variables are not factored into whatsoever the status quo so far of energy modeling, right?
I think that it would be really great if it could be acknowledged that we build a building and we don't know how much energy it's going to use.
Well,
and there's some things.
I'm so glad that you brought up the living building challenge, because for building, and there are very few of them, to my knowledge, to live to the standard of the Cascade Building Living Building Challenge. Well, that's a net zero building proposition, where the building generates as much energy as it uses, and the Omega Institute's Living Building Center their greenhouse with the swamp in it, you know, the one up in Rhinebeck, just recently got certified as a living building. But they've got a huge, big-ass PV array in the front yard, and it's basically a greenhouse. And so, yeah, it's a low-energy use building inherently, but it's got photovoltaics, and I think that's kind of cheating the issue. I look for a day when we use natural thermal currents to help ventilate the building, so that when the grid goes down, and I think it's going to go down increasingly as the world gets more complicated and more electrical use replaces things like sitting by the window instead of turning on a light. It's just my sort of pro-Luddite approach. I would look towards more collaboration between scientists and architects and designers to look for using just naturally occurring phenomena. Stop with the electricity use, which is one of my beefs with the Passive House, because they use their HRVs to temper air going in and out with the super thick insulated walls, which in Europe they're mostly using XPS type insulation, which then uses petroleum products, not only in the stuff itself, but with the blowing agents, and I don't think that that is, shall we say, sustainable, because I don't think that we're going to be making petroleum-based insulation 50 years from now when oil has run out.
Well, this is, you know, obviously an extremely complex issue, you know, and architects are, you know, they're in an amazing time right now, because we have, you know, ancient technologies that we know work, and then we do have a lot of modern materials that we can use as well.
Right.
My position on insulation is that all insulation is good. I don't hold a love or a hate for any particular one, but I think there are appropriate places for different types of insulation. You mentioned a lot of things in what you were talking about, a lot of things that I could pick up on here. I guess...
pick one.
You know, pick but I'm not familiar with the Living Building Challenge per se. I know people that are very involved in it and really appreciate it, and I just haven't spent the time with it.
Well, but if you compare that to the endless checklists of USGBC, it's more like a haiku.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's four petals, and they represent things, and it's all rather metaphorical.
Yeah.
So it's lyrical instead of listical.
Well, that sounds nice. The holistic approach, at least from my mind, is you need to create a good air barrier, especially if you're in a cold climate, in order to be able to manage the movement of air inside of the building. I think that, and on top of that, you need a great insulation system, and then you need to have room-by-room thermostatic control inside of the building so that the building can respond to its environment. So, say, on the south side of a building where you're getting solar energy into the building to heat it, the heat can turn off. You know, so you need that room-by-room thermostatic control in order for the building to kind of be within its climate.
And that's cheap if you've got a hot water recirculating system with hot water radiators.
Yes.
You can have individual thermostats
Absolutely.
In your rooms.
Yeah, which is something that, you know, Henry and I have been putting in buildings for years. We love it. It's code in Europe to do. We really like heating, and we also have a building now that we have cooling with water.
Through radiators?
A system called valances, where they create a convective loop in the room, no fans. This building is going to be occupied in 2 days. I'm very excited about it. It's up in the Bronx. It's an 80-unit special needs housing building.
Wow.
So we'll be able to show some energy bills on that one within the next year.
Now, how does the cooling work? So there's a fin tube sort of
Correct.
Device someplace?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There's no fan?
No fan. The fin tube... it looks like a piece of baseboard radiator, except that it's located in the corner up between the wall and the ceiling. And it's set away from the wall and the ceiling so that air can rise and drop around it and create the cooling for the room.
Because then you're introducing a cool layer at the ceiling, which then wants to drop to the floor.
Precisely.
That sets up your convection.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after it's occupied, you're going to somehow... get some metrics off of this?
Oh, yeah. We'll be watching the bills. And also, the heat taken from the air during the air conditioning season gets moved into the domestic hot water. So we get free domestic hot water from the air conditioning.
Free? Wow.
Yeah. Very exciting.
That's pretty hot. What do you do in the wintertime?
Well, in the winter, we don't have air conditioning, so we would then be making hot water with a coil in the boiler.
Uh-huh.
So for, you know, at least the cooling season, we're getting the free domestic hot water. But anyway, just back to just something that I wanted to just express here, which is that
Sure.
I think there's real fundamentals to making these buildings perform really well. And they are, you know, making this building tight, giving it an air barrier, insulating it well, managing the glass, room-by-room thermostatic control, and ventilating it well. And those are things that, you know, can be played with by an architect. They're tools that can be used. When that gets boiled down to any kind of point system or any kind of rating system or a set of rules, it starts to corrupt. And it's not as effective as someone who can take a holistic view. And so I have, you know, big problems with a lot of these rating systems. I feel that they don't accomplish much. On the other hand, you know, something like LEED will say that if you have a certain amount of points, this is a measure of something, which I think is really just a wholesale farce. But they've been very smart in picking up the word measure. They understand that we need to measure things. They're just using numbers and calling them a measurement.
Yeah. Well, it's a predictor. It's not really a measurement. It's a predictor. In fact, what we really want is just to make a nice place for people to live in. Jack, can we have the next break music, please?
I light the fire. You place the flowers in the walls that you bought today. Staring at the fire. Through them fiery gems for you.
Yes, that is what we are. That's what we're after. Flowers and warmth and making a better place for the people who will use the buildings that we are building for them. Let's talk about the... I'm here with Chris Benedict, architect of New York, a fellow Cooper Union alum.
Yes.
Free Cooper Union! Gotta
Yahoo.
Say that. Last week was my rant about that. I highly recommend it. I lost my temper without losing it. Yay! In New York City, we have zoning ordinances, as do most places on the planet with any sort of population. And the City Planning Commission holds immense power in New York City. And they have proposed a whole bunch of changes to the zoning code. Tell us about some of those and what your role was.
Well, I was on a task force called the Mayor's Task Force for Greening the Code. And a number of people in the city were convened to talk about the code issues that we've encountered over the years with regard to energy or green. And it was a pretty long and interesting discussion. I was in the enclosure group. I was in the enclosure and ventilation group. So I put forth...
What were the other groups?
Oh, I think there was...
The planting flowers group.
There was mechanical. There was electric. There were, people dealing with, large corporate skyscrapers, which is really outside of my area of expertise. Uh-huh. A lot of different people were brought together. I happen to be a big fan of insulation. I talk about insulation a lot. I go around the country talking about insulation. I like insulation. And so the measures that I wanted to put forward really had to do with the building enclosure and insulation. I have tried to insulate buildings really well and continuously. And on new construction, it means usually that you put that insulation on the outside. So most of the buildings I've designed are built with block and plank. So the block and plank of the building is built, and then we're applying insulation to the outside of that building, and then some kind of exterior finish. It's either brick or a panel system, or it could be EIFS. Those are basically the three that I've worked with.
Ew. EIFS.
Not a big fan
that
of EIFS.
It stands for Exterior Insulative Finish System. It's the crap that you see peeling off of buildings after a hurricane in Florida.
Well, you see, I would take an opposite point of view with that. I happen to think EIFS is really an excellent system. It has been really trashed by a lot of people, and there's been a lot of very poor workmanship with it. But it's actually a really wonderful way to get continuous insulation. So why do I want continuous insulation? Because this way I can really control what we call in the building science world thermal bridging, which is places in the building where you don't have a lot of insulation and heat can be moving either out of the building through them or heat can be moving into the building. And then if the heat's moving out, you need to put more heat in to keep the building warm. And if it's moving in, you need to be removing it with an air conditioning system. So getting your insulation on the outside where it's not interrupted by pipes and wires and studs and partitions is really a great way to insulate a building. And it's also very interesting, I think, for architects, because we would like to put insulation on the outside of existing buildings if possible. This is going to change the identity of buildings.
Yes, there's unfortunately, we can't always do that.
Yeah, there's huge opportunities for architects with this. So, for zoning...
But in the future, when the zoning amendments change... Okay.
In zoning... That additional thickness that you add to the building also adds to what is called floor area in the zoning resolution. And a lot of buildings, especially existing ones, are overbuilt on their sites right now. They're existing non-complying buildings. They were built before zoning.
Yeah.
And so when you're adding insulation to these buildings, you start to trespass on the zoning resolution and you're not allowed. So I wrote two measures. One was to be allowed to add insulation to the exterior of the building without the zoning penalties. And the second measure was for new construction to be able to put thick insulation in the buildings and not take the floor area penalty. So the two measures that have been put forth now that are in front of community boards around the city right now are to allow these two things to happen. So in new construction, you can make thickly insulated walls and not take the penalty. And this is great for developers who had to who really didn't want to put thick insulation in the buildings because they lost interior floor area in their apartments or any other type of building. And in existing buildings, you just basically weren't allowed to do this at all. So this is a great opportunity now to get these buildings to become very low energy users. Potentially, you know, they could be to the level of passive house, although it's difficult to get existing buildings to meet the passive house certification.
Sure, but more insulation and lower operating cost is great for a developer or owner who's going to have rental apartments. How do we make that case for a for-profit developer who's doing condos, for example?
It's hard to make the case. I mean, I would say that given the popularity of LEED, it would be nice if insulation had that same kind of popularity. I mean, people, it appears, are really sold on making some contribution to the environment. You know, and so potentially, you know, well-insulated buildings can have that same kind of cachet. Although, you know, a lot of the things in buildings are not, you know, a lot of things that help building performance are not the sexy stuff.
Right.
It's the insulation. It's
right.
The air sealing. It's the caulk. You know, it's those types of items that are making buildings perform well.
Sure. One of the things that you haven't mentioned, which has been a very popular sort of aesthetic architectural trope for the last 80 years, is the brise-soleil, the overhang, the overhanging sunbreaker. What's your take on that?
I think it's a great idea. I mean, you can pretty easily understand how sun shines on your building. There's a free program called SketchUp that you can use, and you can take your building design and pop it right down onto Google Earth, and you can see how the sun shines on your building, and you can understand how to shade it, and you can learn from ASHRAE information what the peak times are when your building would be getting the amount of BTUs that you would need to be removing by the
right.
air conditioning. You can pinpoint that in SketchUp and shade your building. It's a beautiful thing, and it really is another great architectural opportunity.
I think Ryan has something to say.
Yeah, no, this is a question I've had for you throughout this whole program, Chris, is what are the tools that you use both for yourself and your office to design these buildings, and then how do those tools, you know, could maybe be used to share this information with other people?
Well, we crunch numbers. We've set up programs to understand peak loads of buildings. We don't model the buildings to figure out a year's energy use. We don't model the buildings to compare our building to a baseline building and then the improvements we're making. We don't get involved in that kind of fantasy world. We do peak load calculations for heating and air conditioning. We look at the building in SketchUp, and we stick it down on the site, and we figure out how we can shade the building well. And we understand how the various methods of creating air barriers, and we make sure that that's designed and detailed in the drawings. Henry designs the heating and cooling systems for the buildings, mm-hmm. And he draws them in 3D AutoCAD MEP.
Okay.
So they're really nicely coordinated and, you know, right there with all the piping. And the ventilation systems, we crunch fairly typical numbers, you know, mm-hmm. fairly straightforward calculations for them. But we're not using big, high technology, fancy stuff
BIM,
to
yeah.
do this.
What
no.
about that? Yeah, okay.
No, we haven't needed it yet. Mm-hmm.
Good. Well, there's just one last thing that we need to talk about in this episode. I do hope that you'll come back.
Oh, I'd love to.
I mean, there's so much more we can talk about, but we only really have about an hour. Jack, let's have one more break and come back and talk about the USGBC.
Thank you.
Burning Down the House with Chris Benedict, talking about low-tech, high-performance. So, Chris, what do you do when you get a client, or have you had a client, who comes and says, well, I want a LEED building? Well, you don't do LEED, do you?
I don't do drugs, I don't drink, and I don't do LEED.
Okay, well, so after you tell them that, then what? Do you go ahead and hire a LEED consultant to confirm that the building that you and Henry are going to design for them probably could be LEED certified anyway, or do you just tell them, hey, you don't want that anyhow?
I haven't had to be in that.
This becomes a political
situation,
thing, yeah. Almost like a religious conversation in some contexts,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
My preference would be to not have a LEED consultant involved in any of my work. And I haven't had that yet, so I'm not sure how I would handle it. But the first thing I would do is really talk to a potential client about, you know, what is it that you want from LEED? And, you know, is it something that you can have by not having LEED? Or is it really the cachet of LEED, you know, that I wouldn't be providing for someone? What I provide is a building that performs really well and makes a beautiful environment for people who live and work in the building.
Well, one of the problems with comparing a building, or if you're doing an energy model and comparing it with the ASHRAE standard building, the standard building is shit. I mean, I was just looking at a summary of an energy model for a project that Ryan and I have worked on. And the standard window, for those of you who are civilians, we rate windows not in terms of their insulative, which it would be an R value, but in the inverse of that, which is called a U value. So the standard building's window U value is something horrific, like 0.9 U value, which has practically no insulative value. The prescriptive aspect of the New York State, which is also the New York City Energy Conservation Construction Code, requires, in most cases, a window with a U value of around 0.38, I believe. It depends on the type of building and where it is climatically. There are different climate zones. So that would really be the baseline. And if you can do better than that, well, then that's good, and then you should get, I would think, a point. But LEED refers to ASHRAE, and ASHRAE has a standard building, which would be the kind of building that we might have constructed in 1975 when we didn't bother to put insulation into buildings because, who needs it, you know? Energy was cheap. So there's a failing in referring to ASHRAE, but there's great strength, I suppose, then in referring to good practice and the track record that you've established. Mm-hmm. So how good are your buildings, Chris?
A statistic I could give to you, it's BTUs per square foot per heating degree day.
Okay.
So there was a study done in the 90s of existing apartment buildings in New York City. 400 buildings were measured, and they averaged 24.3 BTUs per square foot per heating degree day.
Mm-hmm.
This was for heating.
Right.
And a building that I designed, and actually we built four of them, they're similar on the Lower East Side, uses 3.8 BTUs per square foot.
Holy shit, that's terrific.
Per heating degree day. And this was done at no additional cost, but with the things I've been talking about. Room-by-room thermostatic control, great air barrier, the ventilation system I described, not mm-hmm. with the ERVs.
Trickle vents and good insulation.
Moving forward, we have two passive houses, two 24-unit apartment buildings that will actually be built, both of them in this neighborhood here. And, you know, they're projected to be, you know, even more better than these results.
Uh-huh.
Probably a third, I think, of crunching the numbers. It's hard to take the passive house standard and the BTUs per square foot per heating degree day and compare them, but they would use about a third of that.
Wow.
So, I see the passive house as really a great way, like any young architects right now who want to learn the types of things that I had to learn by running after building scientists and people in the national labs. And, you know, you can learn a lot of that in a very condensed way now by taking the Passive House training. You can yes. understand a lot of that stuff. So I highly recommend people that are trying to pursue this to go, you know, look at what the Passive House people are doing and go to their seminars and take the classes. And they do have a model. And again, you know, I'm not a big fan of models, but at least the Passive House model, their system is very refined, and it really talks mostly about loads. It's not trying to predict how mechanical systems work, because there's so little mechanical systems in passive houses. So
right.
I find it more reliable, and we'll see how well that turns out.
So your approach to passive house for a multiple dwelling unit is this compartmentalization of each apartment.
Correct.
So you're handling it like a bunch of single-family residences that happen to be in the same structure.
Exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So you're not, to a certain degree, you're not taking advantage of the multiplier of efficiency of having a central heating plant, or are you?
They will have a central heating plant, and it will be a hot water system with the thermostatic radiator valves that we were talking about earlier.
Uh-huh.
We won't be tempering ventilation air, because I don't think that's a strategy that can work here in New York City. Most apartment buildings here in the city are double-loaded corridors, so some are facing south and get great opportunity for solar, and then others are facing north. And the ones that are facing north will not be able to meet the passive house standard. The building as a whole will meet it, which comes up with, it's an interesting issue for people who may want to develop a passive house building, sell condos or co-ops.
Mm-hmm.
Some will comply to the standard and others won't. So you can't really sell every unit in a passive house apartment building with
sure.
our configuration.
Right, capturing excess
yeah.
Solar heat coming in on the south side of the building and distributing it elsewhere in a multiple dwelling unit becomes very difficult.
Yes.
Because we have to put positive pressure in corridors so that you don't smell your neighbor's cooking. That is to say, forcing air from the corridor into your apartment and then exhausting out through the kitchen or toilet exhaust. So we can't be taking heat out of the air from one apartment to the other in that way. So then it'd be some sort of mechanical system, and that becomes complicated, and there would be some real expense there.
Yeah, I mean, our building, both the buildings we have designed right now have ERVs in every apartment, and the hallway ventilation is also done with an ERV, so we're capturing the heat
so
from the hallway.
So is this an off-the-shelf ERV that sits in the toilet and kitchen exhaust?
It connects to the toilet and kitchen, but it's a unit. It's made by a company called Venmar, and it'll sit in the closet. It's a 2-foot by 2-foot unit, and its ductwork will spread out around the building, around the apartment. It will provide fresh air to bedrooms and living rooms, and exhaust out of kitchens and bathrooms.
So you get the fresh air from outside, you temper it in the ERV, and you distribute it through the apartment.
Correct.
Is there also filtration?
There are no filters. We aren't huge believers in the filters. We think that, you know, you filter this air and then you're confronted with this filter full of all kinds of nasty stuff, and you might get the dose that you missed by filtering the air in the first place. So we're not big filter fans.
Huh. Interesting. Well, we'll have to talk about that the next time that you come.
Sounds
this
good.
Has been a conversation about low-tech, high-performance with Chris Benedict. Christine Benedict, I believe.
Chris, please.
But you prefer Chris. Architect in New York City. Do you have a URL for your site?
I actually don't have a website right now, but you can follow me on Twitter starting early this next year. It's at Chris Benedict RA, and we will be twittering out our passive house project progress.
Excellent. This has been Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network.
You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.